So this will be sort of the introduction to GR. This is the first lecture. Okay, and general relativity is primarily a theory of gravity. Which was formulated by Einstein almost precisely 100 years ago. And it posits that gravity is nothing but a manifestation of space-time curvature. The key idea of Einstein was that since gravity affects all objects in the same way, we can associate it with something else that's sort of universal, namely a curvature of space-time. And the curvature of space-time results from a presence of matter in the universe, or more generally, the stress energy momentum tensor. So energy is equated to matter, but a more general way of writing this is capturing all the aspects of energy and stuff by this stress energy momentum tensor, usually denoted by T. It's a two index object. Okay, so such a distribution leads to curving spacetime via the so-called Einstein's equation. Okay, and at the end of this lecture, I'll get to explain what is the Einstein's equation. And in the focus lecture by David later this afternoon, you'll have an actual derivation of Einstein's equation. But Einstein's equation relates precisely the space-time curvature to this matter distribution. And you'll find that this is actually a set of equations for a quantity that that measures sort of the distances, the metric. And so we denote metric by G and the stress tensor. And it's actually a set of second order coupled highly nonlinear PDEs for these quantities as functions of space-time position. And in fact, because it's a second order set of equations, you can even have curvature of spacetime without any matter at all. And in fact, the solutions I'll talk about tomorrow, the black hole solution, is such a thing. So certainly if you have matter, it's going to curve spacetime, but you can have curved spacetime even without any distribution of matter. But the key point in all this is that space-time now is, in general, is curved and dynamical. Okay, and what I mean by dynamical is that it is affected by matter or energy, but matter or energy moves on that space-time in a way that's determined by the space-time geometry. It's sort of trying to follow the straightest possible sort of path in the space-time, but since the space-time it's curved, it sort of has to figure out where to go, and that in turn influences how the space-time curves subsequently. So it's this coupled system. It's sort of the matter back reacts on the space-time, and then that determines how the matter will move. So it's a complicated system. And unlike many of the, almost anything else that you're used to in physics, where you would say quantum field theory, where you would sort of describe the dynamics of your sort of fundamental constituents in the theories, let's say a bunch of particles or fields or something like that, propagating on a fixed arena on some space or space-time, here the space-time is not fixed. It's playing a role of not just the arena, but sort of the star actor in this game. Okay, so that's the that's the complication and simultaneously the beauty of general relativity. So the outline of the lecture is there will be two parts. The first one will be just describing the curvature of spacetime. How do we understand curved spacetime? And the second one will be the describing the dynamics, namely the Einstein's equation. In the second lecture, we will solve the Einstein's equation, or rather, I'll describe the solutions to Einstein's equation. Again, there will be two main parts. There will be black holes, and there will be anti-de Sitter spacetime, and maybe depending on time and your interest, maybe a bit more. Okay, so that's sort of for Wednesday. For today, I'll just be describing the spacetime. Okay, so the first thing to start with is the spacetime is sort of the set of all events in space and time, and usually one needs to specify sort of the manifold and a metric. Okay, so the manifold, for example, in four dimensions, we can have the R4 manifold. It's in general something that locally looks like flat space, let's say RD in D dimensions. Typically, you know, our space-time has one time dimension and three spatial dimensions, so much of general relativity was initially formulated in just four dimensions, E plus one dimensions, but you can generalize to any other number of dimensions. The metric is the sort of key quantity. Okay, so let me talk about the metric. So this sort of measures the, or encodes the distances, distances between neighboring events and time durations. And it implements a dot product between vectors. Okay, so the way that we can write this in GR notation, so what you would usually call, let's say you have two vectors V and W, we can write the dot product by the metric, let's say G mu nu. V mu, the index, stands for this object being a vector. There's another one, W. And this notation, what this notation means is it's employing an Einstein summation convention. So implicitly, you sum over all the repeated indices. In this case, both mu and nu are repeated. And so this, when you see a repeated index like this or like this, you sum over all occurrences. So you can think of this as just a, you know, standard vector multiplication. So this is the, let's say if you have x, y, z, t coordinates, it would be in, there would be a g, xx, vx, wx, plus, and so forth. Okay, so that's the sort of notation, and you can, is that, are you happy with that?
Okay, so because it gives a dot product, it gives not only distances, but angles.
It gives all geometrical information. In particular, if it's a dot product between two same vectors, it gives the norm of a vector.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for that very reason, this will come in importantly in a moment.
Yeah.
Very good, yeah.
Actually, I'm from IT. Someone who's gonna be the chat moderator for this room. Yeah, but someone in the room is going to be moderating the chat.
Okay.
Do you know, did Rob say who it was? Or was it going to be able? Okay.
Okay, maybe while they're sorting it out, then.
Yeah.
So far, so good. You can also implement something that we call lowering and raising indices. Let me just continue here. So you can lower indices with the metric. So you can write, so this is just a notational thing, you can write V, let's say V nu, as G mu nu V mu, or actually let me just switch this. Okay, here we're only summing over the new index. It's a dummy index. I can write anything I want for the repeated ones, but the key thing is that in an equation like this, the free indices that are not repeated have to match in all the terms of the equation. You can also raise indices by an inverse metric. Inverse metric G mu nu is defined via the sort of relation that the metric multiplied by its inverse metric. So think of this as a matrix multiplication. Here's another, there are two free indices here, mu and rho. This is just the standard Kronecker delta function, or identity matrix. Okay, so once you have defined, so for every metric, there's a unique inverse metric. And you can similarly write, let's say, V mu as G mu nu V nu. And so this dot product, then you can write G mu nu V mu W nu as either, you know, V nu W nu or V mu W mu, or since I said that these are arbitrary, you can just call them whatever you want. Okay. Okay, so that's just notational thing. Yeah.
If I think of G mu nu as a matrix indexed by mu mu, then the one with the raised indices would be the
inverse matrix. The inverse of that matrix.
And so the metric has to be invertible.
It has to be invertible. Yeah. And it has to be, well, it's lives in a vector space that has the same dimensions as the space time. Yeah. And
that's what's the difference between G sub mu mu and G super mu?
Yeah, so this is a metric.
No, lower.
This and this. Sub and super mean?
Right. Are they the same or are they transposed?
They're inverses of each other through this relation. So this is G, the metric times the inverse metric is the identity. And here we're doing matrix multiplication. Yeah?
What's the meaning of the last equation, the last equality? I mean, it's just a change of indices.
Exactly. So this is just notationally, there's no meaning. This is up to what you use this for, is up to you. This is just for,
But in all other cases, you are changing the up and the down. The last equality is just. It's just change of indices.
Exactly. It's just change of notation. So I'm saying that any repeated index can be called whatever you want. It's a what we call a dummy index.
It's a
bad. Whereas if you have a free index in an equation, okay, here mu and rho are free indices, they're not repeated. Those you have to keep the same in all the terms of the equation. Okay. Good. All right. So as was noticed previously, so let me actually give you an example of a metric, the flat spacetime metric, which is called Minkowski. Just to illustrate the structure, so this is described by a line. So-called line element. Line element is something that we write as ds squared. It implements a square of infinitesimal separation, an space-time interval, which generalizes a distance in a space. Okay, we can write this as g mu nu dx mu dx nu, where these are all the space-time coordinates. And this is the metric. In this particular case, for Minkowski, we have a special name for the metric. So here, so in Minkowski space, we call the metric eta mu nu. This is just a special name for the flat space time. Otherwise, we just use g. And you can write this out. So eta is a diagonal matrix with minus 1 standing for, so if I have x mu being t, x, y, z, Cartesian coordinates, the tt component is minus 1, and then the xy, xx, yy, and zz components are plus 1s, and the rest is zeros. So writing this out, I get minus dt squared plus dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. Okay, so as you can see, this object just generalizes a standard distance. If you didn't have the time, it would be just Pythagorean theorem in you know, your Euclidean space. Now, one of the important bits about having space-time is that the time direction, as you can see, comes with a minus sign. The metric is no longer a positive definite object. And so you can have zero distances, for example, or negative distances. And that determines the causal character. So causal, well, characterization, let's say, of any vectors. So here I told you that you could find a norm of a vector. The norm of the vector can be positive, zero, or negative with the non-positive definite metric. And so, well, in a on a space-time diagram, let me, if I plot, let's say t and x-axis and the y and z are running out of the board, there's a light cone, which is a separation between the vectors which have positive norm, zero norm, and negative norm. So if I have a vector like this, let's say call it v mu, okay, the v mu is has a positive norm, and we call such a vector space-like vector. If you have something that lies on the light cone, let's say pointing in this direction, okay, let's call this w mu. You can also take something like this, which would be in this case minus w mu. Okay, so you can have plus or minus. So w mu has zero, right? So for example, here you have a t, delta t, dt would be the same as dx. So this distance is zero. Okay, so this is zero. So plus minus w mu corresponds to future, future or past directed null vector, sometimes also referred to as light-like. And finally, the one more color. Finally, pointing inside the light cone like this, let's call this u mu, or similarly minus u mu. So u mu has negative norm. Okay, this is the new stuff compared to, well, both of these are the new bits compared to just Euclidean space or positive definite metric space. These give, again, the plus and minus is future or past directed time-like vector. And so if you have a trajectory of some physical particle, locally, the trajectory must always stay within the local light cone. A general spacetime, so this picture I have drawn for Minkowski space, where you can see things, you know, very explicitly, but in general, any curved spacetime is going to have the ultra-local structure with one time and three spatial directions in four dimensions. And locally, it will have this so-called Lorentzian structure, where there will be a light cone at every point, and the physical observer would have to move faster than the speed of light. The speed of light is exactly like on the light cone. Okay, is this so far familiar? Good. All right. So now the important thing about this Lorentzian structure is that you can ask, what happens if you change? Oops, this is running. Oh. Okay, let's see. This stays. It doesn't stay. Okay, never mind. Well, never mind. You can see the upstairs. It's okay. That's dangerous. That's dangerous. I went, no. I'm going to break it after I put this down. Okay, you manage. All right, fine. okay, so if you imagine that you now are a moving observer, moving with some velocity, then you're in a boosted frame, a given vector is going to look like, say, if you're a time-like observer, sitting, let's say, at the origin, compared to someone who's moving. Ah, and I lost all my chalk. Okay.
There's a rope here.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So compared to someone, there we go. who's moving with some velocity, this guy looks like it's moving, towards the other way, whereas if you had another time-like observer this way, it would look like it's moving, to the left. But the invariant notion is the light cone under this. So the light cone, the light cone is invariant under boosts. Boost just means you change to some constant velocity. And so what happens to the axes here is that they sort of shear like this. The new position would be given like so. So they shear unlike, say, the rotations where you have, say, x and y axis rotated into, let's say, x prime and y prime, like that. In this picture, the invariant is just the origin of the rotation. Here, under this boost transformation, the invariant surface is the entire light cone. Okay, so determining the causal character of a vector, whether it's space-like or time-like or null, that is independent of which frame you're in. Okay, so if you're moving, you might say, well, okay, if you move faster and faster, eventually you might think that you're going faster than speed of light. That's not the case. The more you can accelerate, but you never exceed the speed of light, and in fact, the light cone is the invariant thing. So you can express this mathematically as the metric, the flat space metric is invariant under Lorentz transformations. There's a Lorentz where a vector, let's say v mu, in the new frame is a Lorentz transformed original vector. So this is characterized by lambda mu nu. And so this implements boosts and rotations. But this guy is defined by 8 is the transpose Lorentz transformation times Lorentz transformation. This is invariant under the Lorentz transformation. Okay, so locally, curved spacetime has this structure, but not globally. The flat spacetime has this structure globally. Okay, and so far so good? Yeah. That's its definition. You can have local patches of curved spacetime, or you can have topological identifications and things like that. But flat spacetime on the full R4 is the only one that's globally like that. Okay, so the metric determines this causal character. It also, as I said, measures distances and durations. So this goes under the notion of proper length or proper time. So depending on whether you're sort of time-like or space-like. Yeah.
I lost you in the last
You lost me, okay.
So first of all, what's the definition of Lorentz transformation?
You can define it via being invariant under this Minkowski metric. Okay, it's part of an representation of SO3,1. Examples of it would be so a subgroup of this would be something that would be boosts where you have, for example, cosh by some angle, sinh by some angle, sinh cosh with zeros everywhere else. Or you could combine this with, say, rotations. You can have, you know, cosine of some angle, sine minus sine cosine, and so forth. Okay, you can have combinations of these things. So all the transformations that are, so there's symmetries of Minkowski spacetimes are apart from the three translations, there are three rotations around the three axes, and there are three boosts in the three different directions. This captures all of those.
Four
translations, and yeah.
So we could define it as just a set of all linear transformations on x, y, z, and t that preserves the metric.
Yeah, exactly.
So adding the constant vector would not be included?
That's part of the Poincaré group, not the Lorentz group. So the Poincaré group includes the Lorentz group plus the translations, and that's the full set of invariances, 10 invariances of Minkowski spacetime. So this just has the 6. Okay, good. So proper length or time, let me just call it L for genericity, is defined, well, heuristically it's like a square root of the square of the infinitesimal interval. So if you have some curve, C, you add up this little line elements for these intervals under some parameterization. So if we parameterize this curve by, say, lambda, it's lambda naught, lambda 1, and so forth, you want to add up the tangent vector, the norm of the tangent vector, at each point here. And so to each tangent vector, if you parameterize the curve by, let's say, a set of x mu of lambda, okay, so this is, you pick some coordinates, x mu. The curve then is described by, in d dimensions, d functions, x mu of lambda. This length of the curve from some starting point to some final point, let's say lambda f, is then given by, so you start somewhere, you end somewhere, and then this guy is, you're taking the absolute value of exactly the the tangent vector norm. The tangent vector here is given by x dot mu, which I'll define as dx mu, which are these functions of lambda d lambda. Okay, this is a vector, and you're adding up its norm, so you're adding up g mu nu x dot nu, and integrating over the parameter. Okay, so these are all manifestly functions of lambda, and so are these. The metric in general will be will have all components that are functions of the space-time position, and then you plug in what are those values at the given x that you're, well, maybe I should write this with some other coordinate, not to be confusing, with what the values of the metric functions are along this curve. Okay, so this counts if the curve is space-like, this would count a proper length along that curve, and that's an invariant under all choices of coordinates and all choices of parameterization. Similarly, if the curve is time-like, then it counts a proper time. This would be correspond to the actual time that you would, say, feel as an observer, you know, how quickly you would age along some trajectory. So if you have an accelerated trajectory on a space-time diagram, you know, if you always have to be moving within the light cone, but you can be moving sort of fast like this. At these points, this guy is going to be very small, so you age very little. And if you're moving, you know, if you're less boosted, you're going to have larger proper time duration like this. Okay, so since you have all seen GR, maybe I don't need to give example, but I'll give you a chance to practice with this in the problem sets.
Does this quantity have some interpretation when the curve is neither time-like nor space-like?
So if it's null, this is going to be zero.
But if I have something which is mixed?
If you have something which is mixed, then typically it's not going to correspond to something very interesting. So typically we talk about things like physical observers. They will always be on time-like or at best null curves. If it's massless particle, it's on null curve. If it's massive, it's on time-like curve. We also talk about various probes like space-like geodesics and so forth that are not to be thought of as physical objects, but nevertheless something that's geometrical and interesting and maybe corresponding to some other nice quantities. But there's nothing that I know of that would be a sort of a mixture. So a curve, you know, you can have a curve like this on the space-time diagram. I don't think that's ever corresponds to anything that's useful. But you can talk about it. You can sort of add up the lengths. You know, here it would be something negative along here. Here it would be something positive up to here. Then there's some negative number and so forth. So it's well-defined. This is a well-defined object.
But from your definition, it will always give you something positive because you have this
absolute. Oh, sorry. Yeah, fair enough. Right, so, yeah, okay. So for this definition, I should keep, yeah, okay. There's a bit of a convention. When we talk about proper time, we really want to have positive quantity, which is why I've put the absolute value there. But for having this type of object, you should put a minus sign in front of it. If you want to convert from proper time to proper length, and keep everything as one quantity, you should put in the sign. So sorry, but anyway, there is no natural quantity that would be described by that. Yeah.
So in AGS, there are cases that two points has no geodesics between them, so they are neither time-like nor space-like.
No. So this characterization is independent of geodesics entirely. Okay, at every point, for any metric that's Lorentzian, okay, that meaning one time direction, every point of the spacetime has a localite cone. And on that localite cone, if you have, say, a curve, you can define its tangent vector. Yeah. It's some vector. You can check by this characterization whether it's time-like, space-like, or null. And indeed, there might not be geodesics between points, but there are always curves. Okay, and 2 points are space-like separated. Well, 2 points are time-like separated if there exists some time-like curve between them, not necessarily a geodesic. If there does not exist time-like or null curve between them, then they are space-like separated. You can also have space-like curves between time-like separated points, right? But the characterization is good. Okay, but let me get to the geodesic. So now that, well, actually before that, I should talk a little bit, explain a little bit about this invariance. So this length is invariant under reparameterization. So in other words, lambda goes to some function of lambda and coordinate transformations. In other words, if you have, it just depends on the curve and itself, which in different coordinates would be just different set of functions, but curve as a geometrical description of where on the manifold it is, and of course the metric itself. Okay, if you have the same curve on a manifold, but then change the metric underneath, change the actual distances, then of course the length of the curve is going to change. Okay, but it's independent of how you parameterize it and which coordinates you describe it in. In fact, general relativity is a diffeomorphism invariant theory. It doesn't depend. None of the physical quantities depend on your choice of coordinates. Okay, so all physical. This also goes under the name of generally covariant. All physical or geometrical quantities are invariant under coordinate change, or independent of coordinates. Yes, I mean, that makes it sound tautological, but indeed. I mean, it's something that you would expect. So in particular, but okay, it sort of explains if you have a proper length, that is a geometrical quantity. All right, so I guess you have all seen, you know, let me just give an example of coordinate transformations just to bring you on the same page. Let's say just two-plane, Euclidean two-plane, from Cartesian to polar coordinates. So Cartesian meaning, let's say, x, y, and here I label the polar ones by r and phi. Okay, so you have the metric dx squared plus dy squared now. Okay, it's a subset of the flat space, but now just in the two dimensions. Well, you can write x as r cos phi, y as r sine phi. And so from here, dx is dr times cos phi plus, minus r sine phi d phi, and similarly for dy. So if you plug this in, okay, you get dr squared. Once you take dx squared plus dy squared, you'll get dr squared times cos squared phi, and then from here plus sine squared phi, so you'll just get a dr squared. And then the cross term will cancel out between dr d phi, and the d phi squared term will pick up an r squared, and then sine squared phi plus cos squared phi. So there will be just r squared d phi squared. Okay, so this will be the line element for the flat two-dimensional space, but now written in the polar coordinates. And you can see that even though we have just still the same geometrical space, just the flat space, the components of the metric, of course, depend on the coordinate choice, and they can be arbitrarily complicated. I can make a flat space look arbitrarily messy by sufficiently complicated coordinate transformation. And on your problem set, you'll get some practice with checking that the proper length is indeed invariant under all such, but under an example of easy such transformations, sort of dealing with, some quantities are of course more easy to calculate in a suitably chosen set of coordinates. Okay, now let me get to the crux of the point of the curved spacetime. We still are at the first part of just dealing with curved spacetime. What distinguishes then curved spacetime from flat spacetime? If flat spacetime can have arbitrarily complicated looking metric, give you an example, just cartoon example of a curved spacetime instead of a two-plane. So this is the R2. Let's take a two-sphere, S2. Okay, so there are various diagnostics. So in fact, in a set of coordinates where I have sort of, let's call this theta, and then the orbiting, the rotational angle, like here, I had a direction phi. And this was my R. Here I'll have locally, say at the top, it has the same structure here where theta would take place of the radial coordinate, but then it sort of curves. This would have the metric, and you'll get to derive this in the problems class, d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. Okay, so you can see it, small theta, it just looks like flat space in the polar coordinates, but then it does something different. What is the diagnostic of it being curved? Well, one diagnostic is that initially parallel, lines or straightest possible curves don't stay parallel. Okay, here, if we had parallel lines, they would, of course, stay the same distance. Here they don't. If you have, say, parallel lines going up like this, they would meet at the North Pole. So that's one diagnostic. They change, they accelerate, towards each other. Another diagnostic is that if you what's called parallel transport, let me write this out since this is parallel transport a vector, let's say along closed curve. Okay, so what do I mean? I take some curve, I take a vector, and there's a notion in transporting this vector sort of along the curve, keeping it parallel to itself as you go along. When you come back all the way around in flat space, you come back to the same vector. Okay, but in curved space, that doesn't happen. So this doesn't return to itself. And an easy example to see here, let's say we start with this vector like that, and we transport it first around, partway around the equator. Then we go up to the North Pole. And if we go up like this, the vector is going to be pointing like that. And then when we go back, we get a vector that's now rotated, okay, on the two sphere. Okay, so parallel transporting this vector along a curve like this made the vector rotate. Okay, so that's another diagnostic. You can make the same diagnostic for infinitesimal curves. And if you do that exercise, this is captured by a precise quantity by curvature tensor, the Riemann curvature tensor, which is non-zero. Okay, in flat space-time, this curvature tensor that captures the change in a given vector along a given curve, that object will be zero in flat space but non-zero in curved space. So we'll get to that in a moment, but I'll first look at what I mean by lines, i.e. geodesics, and introduce the notion of geodesics, and then return to this notion of the curvature. Okay, but this is how you would diagnose whether a space-time is curved or not, even independently of how complicated the line element would look like. Yeah?
So I had a question about the coordinate transformation.
Ah, okay, okay.
What would be an example of a theory that's not invariant under this? I mean, I would think normally in any differential equation, you can go to some other coordinates and solve it, and it should be the same. But maybe there's something more to it that I'm missing that's special here.
Any self-respecting theory should be coordinate independent.
Yeah.
But if it may often be that you might write an equation which is written manifestly in terms of some coordinates. Sometimes the quantities, so then you have to decide whether that equation is something that just holds for those coordinates, because you have chosen, some special set of coordinates, or whether it's a genuine sort of tensor equation that would hold for any chosen set of coordinates, and you just happened to choose ones in which it's a simple equation to write. Okay, so there are plenty of examples where you can get equations that look innocuous, but those equations are just things that would work only in a set of coordinates. Okay, so we can sort of come up with examples after the class, but that's the sort of thing that you have to distinguish.
I mean, in such a case, you would just have to say that the coordinates physically matter, right? That would just, the physical content of the theory would then involve those coordinates. But Einstein gave up on coordinate invariance for a while, didn't he, until he realized he could get it.
Yeah, there's lots of historical,
yeah.
GR wasn't as, I'm condensing this in 3 hours, but
yeah.
it certainly took long to
develop.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, so the notion of, by the way, I'm also making a slight here of drawing the vectors like this. The vectors don't actually live in the space-time itself, but in a linear vector space, as all vectors and tensors should. The linear vector space is obtained as a sort of a tangent space at the given point where you're describing the vector, and you transport this tangent space, here it would be a tangent space like that, you transport it from point to point, and there's a machinery associated with that, which for the lack of time I'm not going to explain in any detail, but if it's confusing you what we mean by vectors on curved spacetime, there's a very nifty construction of basically associating them with variations, directional derivatives of any sort of a scalar function on the spacetime, and those directional derivatives behave like vectors. They satisfy all the properties of vectors, and they span this tangent space. Okay, so that's a bit of the formalism of differential geometry that underlies dealing with all the physical quantities, the tensors, living on all these locally tangent spaces, these vector spaces. Okay, but I'm just going to glibly be drawing these pictures as if the vector was on the manifold and manipulate it. Okay, so there's a machinery that goes under the manipulations that I'm just not having time to explain. All right, so let's come back to the notion of these lengths. And in particular, you can use the lengths to define a shortest length curve, okay, which we call a geodesic. Okay, it's the straightest possible, it's the analog of straight line in flat space. It's something that is the sort of straightest possible curve in a curve space time. And to find a geodesic, you solve the so-called geodesic equation. Okay, so okay, so you can think of this as sort of a curve of zero acceleration. It's for time like for time like curves which are geodesics, it's the path followed by physical test particles, massive test particles. This particle is one that has no, that is small, first of all, has no internal degrees of freedom, doesn't spin or anything like that, and is not acted on by any other force. So it just moves in the curved spacetime. So any such path followed by a test particle is going to be a geodesic. Null geodesics, it's path followed by, any path followed by a massless particle is going to be a null geodesic. And, for Lorentzian spacetime, these guys are curves of sort of longest proper time. Whereas for space-like geodesics, in positive definite metric, so Riemannian, what we call Riemannian geometry, so g mu nu is positive definite, like my example, therefore, R2 or S2, this is the curve of shortest length. Okay. You can't do this in Lorentzian spacetime. Space-like geodesic is not really a curve of shortest length, but it's a curve of extremal length. Okay, you can always decrease the length by making it nearly null, right? And then you can make, if you have a space-time, you want something like this, a shortest length, shortest path. But if you made the curve deformed like this, it would have zero length. So that's why it's not, full characterization. But it's still an extremum of length in the sense that if you vary this curve around, the extremum of length is a geodesic. Okay, and you can use that observation to write an equation which gives you whose solution is the geodesic. And in particular, you can determine the geodesics from an action. And you could take an action which is simply the proper length that we have defined up there. But it's actually more convenient to take an action that's the sort of a square of the incremental length. This is no longer invariant under reparameterizations. And that's actually a feature rather than a bug, because it actually determines a geodesic which is affinely parameterized, whose parameter along that curve, that lambda, picks the same increments as you go along. And that's what gives you sort of zero acceleration. The tangent vector, as you transport it along that curve, remains always the same. Okay, so that's the advantage of taking this action. Okay, so if I write this out, so let me write in some x mu coordinates, I have the geodesic given by the set x mu of lambda. Okay, I can write the action simply by g mu nu x dot nu, okay, d lambda. Okay, so that's my action. And if I vary the action and find its extremum, I get the geodesic equation okay, so delta S equal to 0 gives the geodesic. Okay, I'll write it. So this is a second derivative of x mu with respect to lambda. Okay, d2 d lambda squared of x mu of lambda. Okay, plus a quantity which I'll define momentarily. I'll write it in the shorthand as a 3 index object, gamma mu alpha beta, and then x dot alpha, x dot beta is 0. Now these guys are the so-called Christoffel symbols. Which are defined with respect to they're just constructed from the metric and the inverse metric as 1/2 times the inverse metric. Now I'll introduce an index to sum over. This is some dummy index. And I have the partial with respect to x alpha, that's d alpha, of g beta gamma plus partial with respect to beta of g alpha gamma minus partial with respect to x gamma of g alpha beta. Okay, so what are these things? So first of all, this is d d x alpha. The metric is easy, that we have already seen, and you sum over the dummy index, gamma. And these are then in the geodesic equation, all the x mu's, or x alphas, or what have you, are functions of lambda. Okay, you're finding some curve in x mu parameterized by lambda. Okay, so this is described by x mu of lambda. And the metric is, again, a function of x. And along the curve, it's a function of lambda. Okay, so this is, in general, some. And there's d of these guys. Okay, for you have an equation for each component, mu here. That's the only free index. Okay, so there's d coupled ODEs, second order ODEs, that give you a geodesic, namely one of these special curves that, well, in Riemannian geometry, minimize the legs.
Just a notation question.
Yeah.
If you put the subscript alpha beta to the right, is that different than if you would put the mu superscript to the right? Or do they commute with each other?
Sorry. So this is a definition of the symbol.
Yeah.
It does not commute in the sense that this is a convention. Well, there's various conventions. Okay, so some textbooks might permute this, but this object is manifestly symmetric with respect to swapping alpha and beta. It would not be symmetric with respect to swapping, let's say, alpha and mu if you lower the mu. It's actually confusingly not a tensor.
Just shift the alpha and beta over to the left and shift,
Okay, that's a matter of convention. Right. So our convention will be always writing the symbol like this.
So like the order of if we raise first and then lower, or if we lower first and then raise, is it commutative with respect to those two things?
Well, this object, not because it's actually not a tensor. Oh. It's defined by writing a set of coordinates and then writing the partials with respect to these.
I see.
Okay, so it's not a component.
This is coordinate dependent.
This one is coordinate dependent manifestly because we're taking partial derivatives with these. Differences between these are genuine tensors, and they will be, you can transform coordinates and they will transform properly and so forth. These you should take just as a, once you pick your coordinates, okay, you can write this set of equations, and it's going to give you a...
So if it had been a tensor, then it wouldn't matter if we had lowered first or raised first.
Yes, indeed. Different.
We already have a definition of proper length.
Yes.
Can you explain again why you have to introduce a new action?
Well, for two reasons. One is convenience, because it's easier to not deal with the square root. But one is... the more important one is that we're getting something for free. We're getting the parameterization fixed. We're finding a finely parameterized geodesic rather than a geodesic whose parameter is just any sort of parameter. This was independent of the parameterization. So if we use this, we would not be able to fix parameterization because it just didn't know about parameterization. It was reparameterization invariant. That one is not.
Will also fulfill some extremal conditions according to the
direction. Yes, indeed. So what you get is on the manifold, you find the same curve using this action. It's just that you won't find the ticking off of the parameter. So you can, so locally, if you ask what is the change in the tangent vector, okay, if you choose some non-affine parameterization, that change can happen. There will be acceleration, but the acceleration will be parallel with the tangent vector. Okay, so that's a more general definition of a geodesic. It's the same curve on the spacetime. The advantage of this is that it's the curve along with a parameterization that takes off equal distances as you go along. And so if you have a time-like curve, it takes off constant unit of proper time. If you have a space-like geodesic, it takes off constant unit of proper length. In this parameter lambda.
Are you later going to define parallel transport, or what that was in terms of the metric?
No, I can do it after class, but I'm very short on time.
Right. Avoid this null-like option that you mentioned before.
Oh, you can still you can actually now go back and still use this to find null geodesics as well. Even though the proper length is, I mean, the motivation is from having some, null geodesics are still extrema. So you can use geodesic equations you obtain from this to find all geodesics.
Right.
Even though the length, the norm of the tangent vector is zero. But it's still an extremum, and so you can still... Well, one way you can think of it is if you have a family of geodesics you can take a family of geodesics where you can make it effectively an energy, for example, or a parameter associated with it bigger and bigger such that the time-like geodesics become null. sort of take the faster and faster inertial observer, or similarly sneak up on it from the space-like direction. And so you can think of the null geodesic in this limiting sense if you want. That might make you more comfortable about being able to use this universally. All right. There's a nifty trick of finding the geodesic equation and solving it without going through this tedious procedure. I think I need to sort of keep moving on, so I might not get to. I'll postpone that trick to see if I have any time at the end of the class, but let me just say in words. So in words, you can find, first of all, you can find the Christoffel symbols for a given line element. Let's take, say, this line element, or this one you'll do in the problems session, by not tediously evaluating this for each of the components here. You know, in d-dimensional space-time, you have d-cube components, but you can write already that action explicitly. Okay, so for example, for this line element, it would be r dot squared plus r squared phi dot squared. You vary that action with respect to r of lambda and with respect to phi of lambda, and you set the variation to zero. So that gives you an equation, let's say r double dot plus something r phi dot squared equals zero, or whatever you get after varying this. And from that, you can read off the Christoffel symbols, because that equation already would have only some components here. You wouldn't have, say, r dot phi dot, and so you know that gamma r phi equals zero automatically without actually evaluating it this way, and so forth. So you get the geodesic equations directly from the action more easily than just plugging through this. The other comment is that you can use, if the space-time has some symmetry, okay, for example, here there's explicit invariance under moving in x, changing, translating x or translating y, then you can, to each such symmetry, there's an associated constant of motion along the geodesic, and you can make use of it. Rather than getting a second-order equation, you get a first-order equation, which is, of course, much easier to solve by integrating. So I was going to give you a very explicit, simple example, but since I have 15 minutes left for, you know, all of the telling you about curvature and all of the dynamics, I'll skip that as well. But if you haven't seen this and would like to see this, then come ask me either after the class or I'll explain it in the problem sessions. All right, so, but this at least defines for you the quantity. Okay, I haven't told you nicely how to calculate, given you a nice example of calculating it, but you have the definition. Let's move on to the other point that I raised here, the curvature. The curvature is what mathematically captures this parallel transport notion. Okay, so I won't derive curvature for you, but again, I'll give you the formula analogously to that. Okay, so the curvature is characterized by a tensor, a four-index tensor, the Riemann curvature tensor. It's four-index because, well, motivated by this picture, you want a parallel transport of a vector along some infinitesimal closed loop like this. Okay, you have two indices to capture what it does to a vector, one for the original vector, one for the final one, and two indices for describing a loop like this, say a vector and then another vector. Okay, so there will be a four-index object. So curvature. So this Riemann curvature tensor is denoted by R with four indices. Again, conventionally, let's write it on the delta, is written with one of them upper. So you can think of the gamma and delta as capturing what happens to the vector under this transporting Kalonka loop, and this to specify the loop. And you can write it, once you have picked your coordinate system, you can write it in terms of these Christoffel symbols as the variation, so partial with respect to x beta of gamma delta alpha gamma plus gamma, there will be a dummy, one dummy index, let's call it mu, alpha gamma gamma delta beta mu, so you're summing over this mu, and you're subtracting off the same expression with alpha and beta exchanged. Okay, so that's some formula that you derive after, again, a bit of machinery that I certainly don't have time for, but you can, again, take this and evaluate it and find the Riemann tensor. But from this tensor, you can, so it's a four-index object, that's quite a bit. You can decompose it into a sort of a traceless part and a trace part. The traceless part is the so-called Weyl tensor. It's typically denoted by C. Okay, this is obtained by taking the Riemann and subtracting from it all the trace, which is contraction of these indices. The trace part is the so-called Ricci tensor. And this is the important object that will come into the dynamics. So R alpha beta is the Riemann, which you contract like so. So you take again sum over mu, you take all these Riemann tensors where you put in a given mu index and you sum over all of them like that. Yeah.
Scott asked earlier about defining parallel transport.
Uh-huh.
I also have a question about this. I guess I don't know the definition, but is it true that parallel transport along the geodesic
Yes, well, parallel transporting the tension vector along a finely parameterized geodesic just keeps the tension vector at every point. If you have another vector, it's going to keep it.
But isn't this how parallel transport's defined?
Yes, exactly.
But this is not the case along a non-geodesic.
That's right.
Okay. And that's how that example works on the sphere. It's like,
you're following geodesic. No. You can parallel transport along any curve.
Right. But it's, the key part of this curve is that it follows a non geodesic path at the top, in the corner. Is that right? When it goes around the corner.
No. That's not the case. You could smooth out the corners and you would get the same.
Let's
push this off, because in the 10 minutes I should get through to set up for the focus lecture this afternoon. So let's come back. Okay, so there is a Ricci tensor, which is given by the trace. And in fact, you can take another trace of this to get the Ricci scalar, okay, which is just labeled by R. And this is R alpha alpha, or you can think of this, of course, as G alpha beta R alpha beta. Okay, and these two objects, the Ricci tensor and the Ricci scalar, are very important. They are the objects that come into describing the dynamics of the spacetime. So again, in your problem session, you'll have a chance to sort of practice with finding these for a simple example, the two-sphere. So in fact, the Riemann has so many symmetries that instead of having, in d dimensions, you would have d to the fourth number of components of this object. But due to the symmetries, you have a 12th of d squared times d squared minus 1, so many fewer. So in two dimensions, you have just one independent component of the Riemann tensor. In four dimensions, you have just 20 components rather than the 256. Yeah.
So these are all honest tensors.
These are all honest tensors, even though the formula contains these Christoffel symbols.
Yeah.
this object is a genuine tensor. And of course, all these are genuine tensors.
So parallel transport intuitively should take as input one vector and a direction you transported it and output another vector, right? That would give you a three-index tensor, right? So I'm still missing the fourth index.
No, you specify the loop along which you're parallel transporting, and that eats up to two indices.
Oh.
It's a map from vectors to vectors. That's two indices, but then you specify the path of, so you can think of a specify that by two vectors.
All right. Go explain it to me. You can go
on. Okay. Right. So then the dynamics. Okay. So this is the second part of the lecture, which is condensed. Okay, the dynamics of the space-time is something that, so this is part B. Dynamics is something that explains to you how the space-time as such actually gets determined by the presence of matter and how does it evolve in time. Okay, so this is given by Einstein's equations, Okay, and let me just write down the Einstein's equation first. So you have the Ricci tensor. Let's write mu nu. R mu nu. You subtract off half of the trace, the Ricci scalar, times the metric. In fact, you can add in an arbitrary constant multiplying a metric. So this is what we call the cosmological constant. And this is related to the stress tensor, T mu nu, where, okay, so what are these things? So this captures the curvature of space-time. Okay. This is a cosmological constant. This is the stress energy momentum tensor, or for short, stress tensor. And this is Newton's constant, gravitational constant. All right, so this knows about the matter distribution, the right-hand side. The left-hand side knows about the space-time geometry. And Einstein's equation relates the two of them. Okay, so this is, let me first describe what it is and then motivate how you get this equation. Okay, so this constitutes, so again, you have a tensor, genuine tensor equation. If you write it in some coordinates, each of these components, of course, is an equation, but these guys are symmetric with respect to swapping mu and nu. So in d dimensions, you have, just d times d plus 1 over 2 equations, one for each component. They're second order in having two derivatives. So remember, up there, I took a one partial of gamma, and the gamma had already one partial. So there are two spatial derivatives. Derivatives with respect to the space-time indices. So second order coupled highly nonlinear set of PDEs for the metric, all the metric functions, g mu nu of x, and the stress tensor as functions of the space-time coordinates. Okay, so this equation has some second up to second order derivatives with respect to all the space-time coordinates of all these different components of the metric and the stress tensor. Okay, so they're very complicated set in general. It's impossible to solve them analytically in full generality. And what makes things worse is this fact that space-time itself, the metric, plays this dual role. It tells you about the geometry, but you can't just, well, you can't, for example, fix the stress tensor first and then solve for what the geometry is, because the stress tensor itself, the distribution of matter, depends on what the space-time metric is. It's typically formulated as, you know, maybe you have some cluster of particles or what have you, but those particles live in the space-time. So that needs to know the metric. So you can't first fix this and then determine that. Okay, you have to solve itself consistently. Conversely, you might say, well, let me just fix some metric and then from that read off the stress tensor just by applying this formula. That also doesn't work because that distribution of matter will not be physical in general. It will give you some negative, locally negative energy or something sick. And so you really have to solve this self-consistently. In fact, even the vacuum solution, so vacuum and zero cosmological constant Einstein's equations. So you have zero here, and by taking a trace, you find that, well, the Ricci is also zero, so that reduces to a very innocuous looking equation of just R mu nu is zero. Even this is very hard and very messy. It's still this whole set of PDEs now just for the metric, but that's still a very complicated set of equations that's in general very hard to solve. Okay, so next time I'll tell you some of the strategies or contexts in which you can find solutions, and we'll see explicit ones. For now, I'll leave it at that. But let me just say, well, first, Gifri, you had a question, or somebody had a question? Okay, so let me just say how you get at this. Okay, the way that Einstein got at this was to write down, well, he wanted to generalize Newtonian gravity to make it consistent with this Lorentzian structure of the space-time. And so you start with the Poisson equation for just Newtonian potential due to some matter density, right? So you have a grad squared of a Newtonian potential is equal to 4 pi g times the matter density. And the Newtonian potential is like the metric. Okay, this guy, you have to take second derivative. This is purely spatial derivative, but you want to promote it to the space-time second derivative quantity in a metric. So as a tensor, a genuine tensor, you want something like the Ricci tensor. Here, of course, the matter density, you want to promote to a, again, rank 2 tensor space-time quantity. That's naturally associated with the stress energy momentum tensor. So the first attempt of Einstein's was to just relate the Ricci tensor to the stress energy momentum tensor like this. That's problematic because this by itself does not need to be conserved, but this has to be conserved. And so then he souped up the equation. He noticed that this object, which people call Einstein tensor, actually has the same conservation property as the stress tensor. So this is conserved. And this is conserved. So the generalization then naturally leads to this. Sorry?
Conserved under what?
Okay, so conserved under variations in space-time. Okay, but this is again something that I won't get to. So this is particular differential operator, the covariant derivative, and it's covariantly conserved in this sense. So this is a generalization. You can think of this as a sort of a partial plus a Christoffel symbol if you write it out. And this is exactly the notion that comes into the defining a geodesic, defining parallel transport, and so forth. But again, this is part of the machinery that I just don't have time to delve into. So at this point, I'm just sort of presenting it at a formulaic level, but I can explain this a bit more after the class. That gives you, so it's this sort of conservation. There's a conservation for this quantity. That's the same type of conservation, this gradient acting on the left-hand side is manifestly zero, geometrically zero.
If you subtracted off RG mu nu without the half, then you would get the Weyl tensor?
Mm.
No.
No, the Weyl tensor is still a four-index tensor. It's the same symmetries as Riemann.
Oh.
It just is the trace-free part of it.
Oh, okay.
It has very nice properties under what's called conformal transformation when you shrink and expand the metric locally.
So can we count, like, how many variables and how many unknowns are there here, right? And how many constraints are there? I mean, so the curvature tensor, right, is like in four dimensions, that would be six parameters, right? Because 3 × 4/2, is that right? Or, you know.
In four dimensions, you have 10.
I'm sorry. Because
it's a symmetric tensor.
It's four, so it's
ten. But then there's
it's 10. Okay.
It's 10.
Okay.
It's 10 equations.
But then,
so these are all functions of the space-time coordinates.
Right. Uh-huh.
Okay. So they're described. We'll see next time how to write and solve the Einstein's equation.
But then T mu nu gives you another 10, right? Is that right?
It's a tensor equation.
Okay.
It has the same number of components. They're both symmetric.
Okay.
D-dimensional tensors.
Okay.
So four-dimensional.
Right.
Okay. Okay. So that. So this was a sort of cheesy way of deriving, quote unquote, the Einstein's equations. There's a much nicer way that you'll hear about in the afternoon. Okay? And that comes from writing an action, the Einstein-Hilbert action. And this is where I'll end. So there's an action principle. You want an action for writing the dynamics of the metric. Of the space-time geometry, okay, it should be an action that's a scalar. Okay, there's an invariant, say in four dimensions or in d dimensions, you have a invariant volume which has a determinant of the metric, so it doesn't change under sort of changing coordinates, or rather, it transforms correctly under changing coordinates. And then you want a scalar quantity here. The simplest scalar quantity that's fully covariant and doesn't depend on your choice of coordinates and is a second derivative object is the Ricci scalar. Okay, so you can write this action, and if you vary that action, with respect to the metric, or actually the inverse metric as a function of the space-time coordinates, you get this bit. You can add in the cosmological constant. Varying this gives you that whole left-hand side. And then the full action, so this is the Einstein-Hilbert part, the full action is the total one is 1 over 16 pi times g Newton of the Einstein-Hilbert action plus a matter action. And the variation of the matter action with respect to the universe metric, delta S matter delta G mu nu with some constants minus 1 over root G, some 2, something like that, gives you gives you the stress tensor. Yeah, let me get the convention right. So this is what you'll derive in the afternoon. Okay, but you can motivate this action as the simplest possible thing. So it's quite remarkable that it turns out that the simplest possible action you can write down actually gives you the theory you want. It gives you general relativity, Einstein's equations, which now have been, confirmed, tested, and hold to very high accuracy in the real world, okay, in our world. So this really, it's a classical theory. It doesn't have any quantum component to it. The space-time itself is a classical object, okay, so we believe that in real world, really, you have to incorporate quantum gravity. This is just a classical theory, but in all instances where we could measure the effects, this is the, you know, this is the correct theory describing what's happening, you know, for classical gravity. But you can generalize to consider other actions. You can have higher derivatives here and so forth that give you more complicated equations. Okay, so I'm now over time, so let me end the first lecture here. Next lecture, I'll talk about how you solve this guy and about the various solutions. But in the meantime, if you want to come back, you know, over the break and ask me about this parallel transport or about finding geodesics more easily or anything else, feel free to, or just stay here over the break so you can come up to me and ask me in detail now.